Everyone, everybody please be seated. We'll go ahead and call our first case, which is case number 59071, Donahue Schreiber Realty Group versus Salinas. Mr. Polzenberg, Mr. Jaffe representing the appellant, Mr. Stovall representing the respondent. For the record, Justice Hartson, you can see, is not here physically in the courtroom. He is here watching live on our internet all the arguments today. He will be participating in these cases and in all the deliberations and the resolution of the cases. Okay, so who's going to go for it, Mr. Jaffe?
Yes, Your Honor. And before I start, Your Honor, Justices, I'm going to use 7.5 minutes, Mr. Polzenberg will use the other 7.5 minutes, and I'm going to try and save a minute for myself for rebuttal.
Very well.
Okay. And I am Stephen Jaffe, Paul Jaffe and Clayton, and I am here on behalf of Donahue Schreiber. May I proceed, sir?
You may proceed.
Thank you. Justices, we are here because Donahue Schreiber is entitled to a new trial on both liability and damages, stemming from errors that took place both during and prior to the trial issue in this case. With respect to the liability issues, I realize that there are several that we've talked about in our brief, and I'm going to try and make through what I believe to be the most important ones, even though all of them, we believe, certainly bear on the case. Most importantly at this point, from our perspective, Your Honor, is the fact that the judge excluded two experts that were key witnesses in this case. And given the fact that the court has, in two opinions since the briefing was completed in this case, addressed some of the expert issues, we believe that the trial judge abused her discretion in excluding Dr. Cohn and LeCocq. Specifically, the trial judge, and actually it wasn't even the trial judge, it was the judge who had the case prior to the actual trial judge, determined that the expert's opinions were too harsh as the basis for excluding them. We believe that that is now it's contravened by several of the opinions that have come out from this court just in the last few months.
Is there anything in the record other than the two letter reports from the two experts of whose exclusion you're complaining?
I don't believe so.
So you don't have a transcript of the hearing on the motion in limine with respect to those experts?
We were looking for that over the weekend and this morning, and we don't believe that it was actually recorded. I was not the trial attorney in the case. Neither trial attorney in the case is here before today, so I can't speak for how and why it was not recorded, but I do not believe that a recording was requested. If so, either Mr. Polzenberg or I, both of us, would have certainly requested that it be transcribed. So with that, we can only go on the minute order that was entered by the judge hearing the issue at the time.
Well, with respect to the report by Mr. LeCocq, his opinions appear to be entirely conclusory. The plaintiff is totally responsible for her actions. She may have lost her balance rather than slipping. Malco did nothing wrong. Donahue Schreiber did nothing wrong. I think it's a closer case with respect to Cohn, but how is that expert testimony designed to assist the jury?
Well, respectfully, Justice, I believe that it was, at least while conclusory, there was certainly some fact base to it within the LeCocq report. I do agree that Dr. Cohn's report was more foundationally sufficient. I believe that one was a clear abuse of discretion. But the fact is that we believe the judge actually stepped down from the bench and put himself into the jury box and usurped the jury's function by making a decision on the weight of the opinion rather than acting as a gatekeeper.
I have difficulties determining the difference between the Elliott testimony you're complaining about and the LeCocq report.
Well, the Elliott testimony, I believe, is different because the Elliott testimony went to duty and that was actually the judicial function to instruct the jury on, while it was couched as standard of care. But in actuality, he was interpreting the contract and talking about a duty imposed upon a landowner, and that was the judge's function. That was not Dave Elliott's function. While the McCoke report may be a conclusion, it still goes to an ultimate conclusion based upon fact of an expert allowed to offer that. So we believe that based upon what was addressed by this court in November in the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department versus Yegazarian opinion, it's 129 advanced opinion 81, and I've only got a slip of opinion in front of me, and I'm looking at page 7, where the court reinforced that under Hallmark, the primary responsibilities of the judge as the gatekeeper were to address qualification, assistance, and the scope of the expert testimony. When compared against the Nevada Power Company opinion from July, where an expert may have had some issues regarding the report, those same types of issues are exactly what the plaintiff complains of in this case, because what they're talking about is an absence of the matter, slip testing that the plaintiff tripped. Those are exactly what this court has already said is what goes to the weight of the evidence and the weight to be attributed by the jury, and that it's not a function for the judge as the gatekeeper, which is why we believe that in this case the judge actually usurped the jury's power and stepped beyond the gatekeeper function set forth in the Hallmark opinion.
Mr. Jaffe, I know I'm interested in two issues. I don't know if you or Mr. Paulson are going to talk about them. That's the collateral source workers' comp payment issue and the apportionment of NRS 41.141. So, Al, you're dividing up the time.
I got workers' comp. Paulson Brothers got comparative. Okay. I'll go into that now, sir.
Okay.
Our position is that the statute mandates that the jury must be told about the amounts paid, and that is very clear from 616C215 subsection 10. But the plaintiff makes an issue suggesting that it was the defense who did not provide it, but the statute does not make it clear that it is the defense who must provide it, or the source by which the court obtains the information. The statute simply states that the jury must receive proof of the amount of all payments made. It doesn't say who must provide it. So it was equally incumbent upon the plaintiff to have provided that information and satisfied the statutory obligation.
Let me ask you this, because I'm reading it and thinking about it over the week, and actually, if we have a situation, if we agree with you, and under Tri-County and the statute, can the court this court instruct the district court to alter the amount of the verdict here to reflect the additional amount of credit that the defense would be entitled to here, or does it require a new trial on that issue?
Well, I think it requires a new trial, but respectfully, Justice, we believe that it is more relevant to even admit medical bills exceeding what workers' comp pay, because the injured person can never be obligated by Nevada statute, and I believe it's NRS 616C.135, to pay anything over and above what the doctor who receives comp benefits accepts. And if that's the case, there can be no basis for admission of anything over and above what workers' comp pays, other than to arbitrarily and artificially increase the barometer by which the jury is going to use medical bills as a basis for any other awards, especially a non-economic damage award.
I'm sympathetic to your policy argument, but I am struggling with the record in this case because I don't see a proffer as to the amount that workers' comp benefits paid, first of all, and secondly, I'm struggling with what appears to be a stipulated admission that the $37,000 treatment was reasonable and necessary. So it sounds to me like you've given up the argument you just made, and then the remainder was $63,000 that was accrued special damages. How are we supposed to assess the impact of the error, and I think it was error, on not putting in the amount of the workers' comp payments when we have no record of what that evidence would have been had it been put in? That puts me in a very difficult position.
I understand precisely what you're saying, Justice, and I understand that the lack of the actual number itself in the record is troubling for me as an advocate, but it doesn't change the fact that it was incumbent upon everybody, and I mean even upon the trial judge, to ask and require of the parties, especially the plaintiff who would have that information, to produce that information so that she could comply with the statutory obligation and give the mandatory instruction.
Let's say we agree with you, but the law is that we can't reverse a judgment on a jury verdict unless we're convinced that it harmed the substantial rights of the party complaining of the error. My question is, how do I assess that impact on your client?
Two things. First off, because of the fact that a motion in limine was filed, I do not believe that we actually did waive the rights to...
I'm not saying that you did. I'm saying, how do I assess how it hurt your case?
I understand. I didn't want to leave that issue untouched because you're basically...
I'm sorry.
I don't mean to talk over you, Justice. I think you can certainly be presumed because we all know from a practical standpoint that jurors will use the economic damages in some way as a basis for rendering a non-economic damage award, whether it's as some sort of a barometer. I mean, we've all heard of old standards of two times, three times, whatever it may very well be. But the point is jurors do use that. The courts have recognized that historically from a policy perspective.
Well, how do I know that the $63,000 isn't exactly what the workers' comp people pay?
Unfortunately, I don't know that answer, and none of us do because it was not in the record. But we believe that it can be presumed that the error by the judge likely had an impact on the deliberative process of the jurors in rendering the amount that was awarded.
Okay. Mr. Jaffe, I know we got about 4.5 minutes, so I'm going to give you an additional minute. I know because you're allocating time for Mr. Pulsman, give the respondent an additional minute as well. But if you'd like to reserve the time for Mr. Pulsenberg in any possible rebuttal.
I was trying to save 7.5 for Mr. Pulsenberg, and I know he has a lot to talk about, so I've gotten through what I needed to get to.
We'll hear about 41.141. Anything else you'd like to bring up?
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Chief Justice Gibbons. May it please the Court, Dan Pulsenberg for Malco, Nevada. Assuming I have 7.5 minutes, I'd like to save 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, unfortunately, you're going to have 5.5, so if you want to save any time for rebuttal, then like that. It says, why don't you go ahead?
Let me start a different way from how I've started every other argument. I've practiced with Rex Jemison for 25 years, and young partners would come in and ask Rex a question about a case in the statute, and he'd always go outside his door, pull one of the NRS blue volumes and say, let's look up the statute. And that was unusual, because all the young partners would say, well, I don't need to look up the statute, I know what it means. And that's the problem we have with 41.141. I mean, we've gone 20 years with everybody thinking they knew what it meant. I bring that up because the four cases that the respondent and amici rely on from Nevada all assume the statute means something when the issue wasn't even in front of them. This is the third case in a trilogy of cases of 41.141, Cafe Moda, Humphreys, now this. This raises the issue whether you have to have the plaintiff's comparative negligence or even the issue of the plaintiff's comparative negligence. Ironically, I would think that Humphreys would have been, if I were designing the universe, Humphreys would have been the third case because it was the final issue. But this picks up an issue that seems to be decided in Cafe Moda but wasn't actually presented.
Before you get too far down the road, could you tell me what standard of review we should apply to your determination that the district court erred in not making liability several as opposed to joint?
The no-go statutory construction.
But you didn't raise the issue until you got to Rule 60B stage, right?
Well, I argue that I raised it in 59A stage.
Okay.
I think everybody knows I'm a rather redundant person, and I made it as a 59E, excuse me, and a 60B motion.
And what's the basis? Legal error?
Yes, the construction of a statute. And I realize there's more deference accorded the district court, but Judge Ellsworth was clear that she thought it was an appropriate 60B motion, even if not a 59E motion, and it presented an issue of law, and she addressed it as an issue of law.
Thank you.
And there's a lot I can say about Buck, and comes up so infrequently anymore, thanks to the more recent cases. But you know, Buck seems to ruminate more than reason. Buck ignores Warmbach versus Blanchard, a case right on point that goes the opposite way just a few years before. It construes the 1973 version of the statute rather than the 1987 version. But I think the one good thing you could say about Buck, if it were correctly decided, is that what it did is it said that the statute's ambiguous. And we have no legislative history from 1973, so we'll construe the statute in light of the common law rule of joint and several liability. The 1987 version, we have a very clear statute, legislative history, excuse me, and it makes very clear that the legislature set to have several liability, not joint and several liability. That doesn't depend on whether the plaintiff was actually contributory at fault, or whether it is even a good faith issue whether the plaintiff was contributory at fault. And I'd like to say 1 minute for rebuttal.
You may do so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Stovall. And we'll have 16 minutes, Tracy.
Good morning. Justin Stovall on behalf of the appellant. On behalf of the respondent, excuse me. This appeal arises from a clean, well-run trial. The trial was conducted by three competent, experienced trial attorneys. In fact, Marsha Stevenson, who represented Malco, is one of the five civil trial advocacy specialists that's listed on the State Bar's website. I emphasize this fact because the parties made conscious, educated decisions to conduct the trial in the way it was in order to effectuate their respective trial strategies. Moreover, the record shows that the parties made conscious, educated agreements to conduct the trial in the way it was, and the trial court accepted these agreements. Most of the issues raised on appeal are improper attempts to second-guess these decisions and agreements with the benefit of hindsight. It is our position that fundamentally, the very operation of the trial court system here in Nevada relies on the ability of trial counsel to make such decisions and agreements. In other words, if this court allows the appellants a second bite at the apple, as they are requesting, this court risks disturbing the very operation of the trial courts and the finality of their judgments.
Counsel, what do we do, though, with the statute that requires workman's comp to be part of the record for the jury to understand what amounts in play?
Your Honor, first of all, the trial court did not preclude the parties from admitting the amount of workers' comp payments. Instead, prior to opening statements, the parties agreed not to give the amount of workers' comp benefits to the jury. And Justice Pickering, I believe, has caught my points exactly because of the questions she's asked.
We've been settling with that particular issue recently, and that is, can parties agree to go outside the statutory construct of what's been required by the legislature? By stipulation. Legislature put it in for a reason, and now counsel's agreeing to void it. Should we accept that?
Well, I believe that with the exception of an expression that this court made in one of their cases, that the legislator here in Nevada did make it clear that it was for the plaintiff's benefit. And so, if the statute is for, and I made these arguments in the brief, if the statute is for the plaintiff's benefit, then it's the plaintiff's to waive, and the plaintiff obviously didn't object to it. I think the problem with this case is that there was no proffer made.
Let me ask you this, though. There were motions in limine, a number of them, that were considered by the judge, one of which was excluding, I believe it was your motion in limine, to exclude any reference to workers' compensation benefits. And she specifically came back and indicated the benefits, the fact that benefits were paid could come in, but she specifically said the amounts were irrelevant and should be excluded. So she did that before any other discussion. You're saying there was a stipulation here, but clearly she considered the motion in limine, and that was her determination.
I honestly don't mean this to sound snarky, but the clerk made that writing. That was a minute order. There is no order, right? There's no written order from the judge, and there's no transcript of the hearing. Okay? What the appellants are saying is that they preserved this objection through their motion, right?
Uh-huh.
And that way it got preserved through the appeal. However, Richmond, right, says that they're asking for a definitive ruling. There was clearly not a definitive ruling in this case because the parties raised it prior to the opening statements.
Well, and that was my impression. I assumed this was resolved prior to the trial, and I can't see anything that indicates it wasn't.
Yeah, my question is the minute order, and this is following up on Justice Pirigo. The minute order says the amount of benefits paid is immaterial, and then they, the jury, are entitled to know plaintiff received workers' comp, but they will be instructed they're not to consider this and comp, you know, so on. But the determination, the amount of benefits paid is immaterial, sounds like a ruling against the appellants on that issue.
I don't have a benefit of the transcript either. Yeah, and I might add, too, again, to quote former Justice Maupin, we don't have minute orders in Nevada. The federal court does. We have minutes, and the minutes weren't reduced to a formal order, so we got this little gap here and as far as what's going on and us trying to review this in the record. But let me get this straight. You know, are you saying you and the plaintiff and the defendant stipulated that there would be no evidence of the amount paid in workers' comp? Is that in the record somewhere that we can look at?
I don't want to be misleading, Your Honor, by saying I don't have a definition of stipulation in front of me. There was an agreement made. And by agreement, I mean Donahue Schreiber did not object and did not make a proffer of the amount that they wanted to admit.
Okay, I don't see that as an agreement.
It is, Your Honor. It's a failure to object. Okay.
Okay, that's fine. And if you characterize it as such, that's fine. But that's not an agreement.
And I'd like to go back to a question that all of this discussion avoids. You never answered Justice Douglas. Are you telling me that something that is clearly set forth by unambiguous statutory language can be stipulated around, agreed around, or just ignored?
I believe that there are a lot of rights that are made for parties, and this goes for the civil system, the criminal system, that are made for parties that are allowed to be waived by that party when it's personal to them.
Because this was a civil case, they must have not meant when they were writing the statute that all collateral sources need to be revealed. It certainly doesn't apply to criminal cases.
This is an exception to the collateral source rule that was designed to keep juries from speculating that claimants had already been paid benefits. Claimants. And what happened is in the case that was cited, and I apologize, it's one case that I don't have off the top of my head, but the case that was thrown around in the briefs is that this court added a sentence that said this also benefits defendants. Alright? And I distinguish this statute from statutes in California, where the California legislature, because of the way it was written, actually has stated that it was meant to benefit defendants. But this statute does not. This statute is meant to benefit plaintiffs, and it can be waived by a plaintiff. But that goes back to
authority for that permissive waiver is what?
Excuse me?
What is the authority upon which you rely to establish or to argue to us that there is a permissive waiver?
The general authority of counsel to enter into agreements at trial is what I cited in our brief.
For example, they can agree to admit hearsay.
Exactly. There are quite a few evidentiary rules, as Justice Pickering has pointed out, that are capable of being waived. But rights, even criminal rights, are capable of being waived, which are much more, I suppose, sacrosanct than.
Okay. Mr. Sullivan, maybe I could direct you on two other issues that were raised by the appellants here, the issue of the excluding the expert witnesses and the 41.141 issue. Could you, did the judge properly exclude these experts? It should have been something that should have been done at the trial? Or what's the procedure, why you feel the judge properly handled the situation with the two experts?
As I said in my briefs, Your Honor, I don't believe that the court should reach that consideration either. They did not provide the transcripts of that motion in the hearing either. And I heard Mr. Jaffe say that he checked and that he didn't think it was recorded, and I'm not accusing him of lying about that, but the fact of the matter is both of the motion limiting hearings, and there's two separate ones, that they're claiming that they preserved these errors through, right? Because they were not objections, right? This was not a trial where there were objections made to these type of things, right? They're not provided in record for this court.
So what we just have, we have the motion in limine, and then was a written order prepared for the motion in limine on the ruling?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a written order, but the written order just said, granted. It was, you know, you wanted this pretrial hearing where it was just like, granted as to Lacoe, granted as to Cohen, denied as to Taylor, denied as to Siegel. These are the doctors that were involved in this.
Why as to Cohen was the testimony inadmissible under the standard that you were benefited by as to Elliott, specifically the second paragraph of Cohen's September 21, 2009 letter looks pretty much like classic expert testimony about slipping events leading to falls when the lead foot slips, et cetera, et cetera. Why was that not properly admitted?
Both of the opinions were based on untrue statements of fact, all right? And it doesn't mean that there wasn't water on the sidewalk, that no one was aware that there was biological matter. There's also a problem with both of the experts with the investigations they conducted. None of them had examined the...
but there was testimony. Your client testified that her heel caught, correct?
Yes.
I mean, she later explains it, but she did say that.
Yes.
So it seems to me Cohen was trying to build on that and say this is an atypical slip and fall because if the heel caught, he has some explanation.
Mm. But there was absolutely... There was no evidence in the record to support that. As a matter of fact, all of the evidence contradicted that. The witnesses that were there said that she slipped and fell on her back. She said that she slipped and fell on her back.
Wouldn't he have a right to present their theory of the case, you know, if there was some evidence to support that point and through their expert, you know, like that? Each side would have a right to do that.
I mean, they do if it's false because it doesn't assist. This is the Hallmark test. It fails on the assistance prompt. And, you know, they accused us of using Daubert, which is not true. We cited Daubert, and then we cited Hallmark. The problem was is that we had a very specific argument, and so my colleague, Mr. Anderson, didn't go through the entire Hallmark process. What he went through was essentially the assistance problem, and we tacked it on that point. And the court agreed with us. And we really wanted the court, obviously, you all know, the judge is, Judge Bixler was given a wide discretion in excluding these experts. And harm was not presumed.
Right. We understand the law. It's just we're trying to get the facts right so we can properly apply the law. So why don't you talk about 41.141 and Mr. Polsenberg's argument, the trilogy of cases we have there on interpreting the statute.
I understand, Your Honor. And I feel like I'm dealing this with all of these issues. Right? But I also agree that this is properly before the court.
Well, tell us why.
What do we call it? Waiver, forfeiture, a judicial admission that leads to judicial estoppel. The fact of the matter is that Marsha Stevenson and Mr. Jaffe, in his pleadings, all admitted that clear enjoyment of civil liability applied to this case. It wasn't until Mr. Polsenberg got involved in the case, right, that this argument came out. And just to address one point, I think another jurisdictional issue is that we're arguing, and it may not be the strongest argument, that Mr. Polsenberg's motion should be considered because of the way he wrote the language in there, a 60A motion, where he had a separate obligation to ask this court to leave to correct an error, as opposed to Foster and Honeycutt, where the court had jurisdiction.
The more interesting issue to me would be what standard of review applies and how can you read the statute as you do consistent with its text? Two issues.
I believe that this is an issue of statutory construction.
So you would agree that it's a de novo review, assuming the motion was proper?
Assuming the motion was proper, although I don't want to
I don't want to put you in an awkward position.
I don't want to concede that there's a more expansive standard than necessary.
I suppose.
Because you're saying they didn't raise it at the proper time, which is when they formulated the judgment and had it entered without objection.
Exactly. So it would be, I suppose, a more narrow standard, Your Honor. Although, to answer the court directly, I don't know offhand. That would be a question that I don't know.
I didn't see it in the briefs, and it was, because you staked your gun on waiver, and they staked their gun on it was a perfectly appropriate motion.
So. That's right. So, to answer your question, so in this case, if this court is going to address joint and several liability, it shouldn't do it in this case because of the effect that it's going to have on judicial estoppel. The appellant's submission that joint and several liability in this case should also support a conclusion by this court that the bench and bar has interpreted MS 41.141 the way the appellants and this court's amici does. Indeed, Ms. Stevenson and Mr. Jaffe, as we said, acknowledge that joint and several liability apply. Also, Judge Skeen, Judge Gates, and Judge Ellsworth. I think that the common interpretation that I'm referring to, that amici does a good job of explaining what I mean by that. See, appellant's position of the legislature was and is aware of the interpretation that the respondents have and had not clarified it because it acquiesced how it was being interpreted. However, the legislature recognizes this court's opinion in Cafe Murda as a departure from that commonly accepted interpretation. By that I mean the way we interpret it and sought to clarify it. I'm surprised that Mr. Polzenberg has not updated this court with the minutes from the most recent legislative session, but I don't want to go into that because I don't know if it would necessarily help our case on appeal.
Well, it's on the record anyway. I guess we can't consider it. So.
Sure.
Anything else you want to add?
Well, at the last legislative session, the legislator drafted the language of Buck. Onto the statute through AB 240.
Okay.
It was enrolled. I believe it passed the assembly unanimously.
But I'm talking about the statute was in effect at the time of this trial. You know.
I don't think so because I read the legislator's action as seeking to clarify it.
Okay.
Not to change it. And so I think that's very important for the court's interpretation. For that reason, I believe that. But the last legislative session was more important than any of the other legislative sessions that were spoken about by Mr. Polzenberg.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Mr. Stovall.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. The committee just Justice Sanders' interpretation of Justice Douglas's question, can we stipulate to get around the statute? That's irrelevant. We didn't stipulate. It's clear from my reading of the record and from my reading of their brief that we had objected, that we had raised the issue that we have to have the exact amount of workers' comp benefits go to the jury. The judge ruled against us, and that was the law of the case. Marsha Stevenson didn't object every time the issue came up, and I know I do, and judges find that incredibly annoying. Mm-hmm. But let me go to what Justice Douglas's question really is. Can you violate a statute? And I would say here that question goes to the issue of whether or not it's reversible error. Here's the statute that says structurally you have to conduct a trial a certain way, and the judge refused to do it that way. Let me go to 41.141. They say it's not preserved. It is preserved. I have a little more time.
You have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Ron. It was preserved. We made a fit, besides the 60B motion, I made a timely 59E motion. And I explained that in the jurisdictional statement, and that raises the issue. Counsel, back off a little on whether, if the motion is correct, the standard of review would be de novo. I think it's clear that it is. And all this about the legislative history for the last session is in my reply brief.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Polzenberg, Mr. Stovall, Mr. Jaffe. We appreciate your excellent arguments and briefs. We'll take the case under submission. And again, Justice Marcy will participate in the decision of this case.
The briefs really were excellent. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Okay, well, we'll do these for a moment.